You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, well, the way we treat death and burial has changed a lot over the years. We'll look back at some unusual historical examples of burial rituals and find out how they're influenced by beliefs about the supernatural. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Vice President Mike Pence was in Wisconsin this week to fundraise and campaign for state Republicans. A Democratic group is targeting reliably red districts with its funding. And after a wet fall, farmers around the state are dealing with wet fields, making it tough to harvest their crops. Robert Mentzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks.
So Vice President Pence was in Green Bay on Wednesday to campaign with Governor Walker and Senate candidate Leah Vukmir. Here's a listen to some of what he had to say.
But I'm here, like all of you, to get behind this good governor one more time. And I just want to touch very briefly on the reasons why we're here. It's because of the man, it's because of the progress, and it's because of the choice that Wisconsin faces.
So talk a little more about Vice President Pence's visit and his support of Wisconsin Republicans, Rob.
Sure. So Pence has been here a few times, and he is, I think I've observed this, but he's really, he and Governor Scott Walker are two peas in a pod. They're both Midwestern governors whose politics came out of the Reagan era. They both combine being quite conservative in their policies and also sort of personally unassuming in manner. They've campaigned before. I wouldn't be shocked to see them campaign together again yet before the election. You know, it's not so much that Pence is necessarily extremely popular in Wisconsin, but he is consistently more popular than President Trump is. That's most opinion polls show that. And so, he comes to town, gets some attention, gets some people out, and hopes to rile up the Republican base.
And Governor Walker is either neck and neck in this race or behind by a chunk, depending on which poll this week you follow. But clearly, if the vice president is here, national Republicans are paying attention to our race for governor here in the state.
You're right. Yeah, no doubt. I mean, Walker, because of the nature of his, how he has governed and the course that he's taken in Wisconsin has become a symbol of a certain brand of Republican politics, and Wisconsin is of importance to President Trump's 2020 prospects. So yeah, I mean they're paying attention to this one.
We're getting a lot of attention from outside groups in Wisconsin on both sides, and not just in the race for governor, a race for Senate, and some of our state legislative seats. Rob, in the campaign world, a Democratic group called Forward Majority is investing $1 million in this election cycle in Wisconsin, but not necessarily the seats you'd expect them to. What's their strategy?
This is sort of interesting, and you know, in the scheme of things, $1 million is not a huge amount, but for some of these races, it's going to be one of the larger amounts spent. Forward Majority is to expand the electoral map for Democrats. They exist to do political spending in places that everyone sort of thinks of as safe Republican seats, which have been historically safe Republican seats. But if it is true that Democrats are headed for some form of a wave election this year, as many indicators would support, it always happens in wave elections that sometimes people who were in safe seats end up not being so safe, that incumbents can fall in surprising places. And so this is part of, the sort of national Democrat effort. This is a Washington D.C. based group to try to put the pieces in place for some of those potential surprises, I guess.
Do you know a couple of the seats they're focusing on that are usually seen as safely Republican districts?
Well, I mean, the greatest example is they say that they're going to spend in Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald's district. That's a very safe Republican district, and Fitzgerald has been around a long time and has a great deal of political capital within that district. That's a fine example of the sort of district that would be actually shocking to see flip. But again, like, this is politics, right? And there are, you know, there may be some benefit to Democrats to having applied pressure even in places that are long shots.
I've seen two schools of thought, even among Democrats, some saying this is a waste of money. It should be spent on closer districts. Others saying these guys did work in Virginia, where there was a dramatic election that was one of the first big pieces of evidence people looked at to say, hey, this could be a real blue wave.
Right. Exactly right. And, you know, there's a bit of a paradox here where part of what happens in a wave election, and we've seen Democratic waves and Republican waves in Wisconsin in the last decade, that races that you wouldn't expect that maybe there was no spending on. So it's not necessarily that it's tied directly to the sort of like amount of dollars spent by an outside group or by candidates. But it is the case that when the conditions are such, some people are going to lose elections people like you and I would not have predicted, you know, 6 months ago or whatever.
Talking to Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network, Wisconsin, rounding up some top news stories from around the state this week. Stepping away from politics, Rob, which is always good to do. We've had a wet summer, a wet October so far. There's a lot of concerns for farmers. What kind of things are we hearing about in the state?
You know, farmers can't catch a break. I mean, it's been a terrible fall. We all know this. It's been raining for weeks. It's cold. I have a head cold, which I feel is very unfair. So it's been the worst. But for me, those are just like inconveniences or minor hassles. But farmers who are already under pressure with the trade war and dealing with tariffs and low prices for some of the commodities, the rain is really serious, actually. The fields are really muddy. It means you can't harvest your corn or your soybeans if you can't get out into the field with your big, heavy machinery. It's a real risk that some portion of these harvests might not be doable if it doesn't sort of dry out soon.
It sounds like, Rob, there's a race against the clock. The fields have to dry out in time to get that equipment out there before it freezes too hard and kills some of these crops. That's what has farmers worried?
Right, exactly so, yeah. And Rick Barrett of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel wrote about this and was looking at some of the weekly ag reports. There was an observer in Adams and Juneau counties who wrote that some corn and soybeans have been standing in water for over a month. Soybeans are turning black in the field. Corn is falling over. Very depressing. That's the quote from this report. And, you know, I mean, some people are going to be hit worse than others. But again, it comes at a time when, like, soybean prices have already fallen a great deal in the last year, and soybeans are directly affected by new Chinese tariffs. So it's just like another complication, another problem that these farmers don't need.
We'll be watching that harvest over the next week. And finally, Rob, a story out of the Sheboygan Press this week looking at the fall and rise of a Wisconsin soda brand, Jolly Good. A familiar name for a lot of people in Wisconsin. Jog our memory about the soda.
Jolly Good soda. Yeah, this is a real nostalgia object for a lot of Wisconsinites. So this is a regional soda produced in a random lake, Wisconsin, near Sheboygan. That was very popular in the 1980s, 1990s. You get a lot of Generation X and old millennials who have some fond memories of drinking Jolly Good as kids. It went away, it sort of declined, and eventually was discontinued in 2007, and came back about two and a half years ago. And a lot of people have been very excited about it. And, yeah, this was really my colleague Marina Affo did a sort of deep dive into what was behind that, how it was that it came back, and some of the people's sort of nostalgic connections to the soda, which it turns out are substantial.
And it sounds like it was crowded out because of it was tough to get shelf space in stores. The big soda brands kind of monopolized what placement you could get in stores. Well, now all of a sudden people like local regional stuff. Is that part of the story of the comeback?
That's exactly it. No, yeah, that's exactly it. It was sort of pressured out of the business, and at the same time, this company that makes it, Cryer Foods, they do like packaging of other sodas, juices, and other foods, and that side of their business was growing at the same time that their soda side was shrinking. So they made a business decision. But yeah, this is the bringing it back is specifically as a play for you know what, people kind of like regional sodas or oddball candies and other things that are not like something that you can get anywhere in any 7-Eleven or whatever. So yeah, Jolly Good is back for a niche audience.
Rob, it's been jolly good talking to you, and I hope you get over that cold.
All right, thank you.
Robert Mentzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He was with us for our weekly look at news from around the state. The way that people treat death and burials differs a lot, depending on the location, culture, or the time period. Our next guest has found those practices have often been shaped by fear of things like vampires, ghosts, even of being buried alive. Chad Lewis is a researcher, author, and lecturer who's traveled the world in search of the strange and supernatural. He'll be talking about burial traditions at the Sun Prairie Public Library on Wednesday, October 17th at 6:30. Chad, welcome back to Central Time.
Happy October to you.
You too. Well, I know this is your busy month, so thanks for taking a few moments with us today. Chad, what got you interested? I know you follow stories of the supernatural and local folklore. What got you interested in the way we think about death and burials?
It was really working on a series of books about old deaths. And what I was finding is the obituaries back then were much different than today's, where today's is something like Old Man Lewis died peacefully surrounded by his loving family. Back then, they included all the grisly details of the death, so much so that it's like reading a horror novel back then. And that got me started about how people viewed death, how they were closer to it, and what they did to avoid it, or at least avoid those coming back from it.
And we kind of sanitized it a lot in the modern days. You're not going to see those, for example, grisly details in most obituaries, for example.
Yes, they don't list how the death occurred, none of the circumstances, and we removed death from our life. That oftentimes in the old days, people died in their homes. They had the funeral there. They had the wake there. They would take photographs with the dead as a souvenir. It may be the only picture they had of the deceased. And they'd have the funeral right in their parlor, hence the term funeral parlor. But today we've kind of outsourced it all. People go to hospice, and then the funeral director takes care of it all. So I think we're a bit more removed from it today than they were in the old days.
You're going to be talking about some burial techniques and customs at the Sun Prairie Public Library. Let's get a sneak preview with some of the things. A lot of things people used to do were based on what I see as a very rational fear. People worried that they were going to be buried alive.
This may seem a little silly today with modern science and medicine, but whether you were in a diabetic shock or in a coma, doctors would often pronounce you dead. And lo and behold, many people would pop up just in the nick of time to be saved from being buried alive. So they were terrified of it. So they came up with several inventions, one of which was a spring-loaded coffin that had a handle on the inside. So if you awoke and found yourself buried alive, you could pull the handle and it would flip the top of the coffin up. I don't know how well it worked with 6 feet of dirt on top of it, but I do have numerous accounts of pallbearers not being careful as they should and moving the body, and it triggered that lever and up came the top of the casket, giving everyone quite the scare.
Oh boy, that's not good. Did you come across any stories of somebody pulling the lever, like waking up in the casket and, you know, pulling the lever just in time before they got buried?
Not with the spring-loaded caskets, because they were very rare. And the same goes for the cemetery bell. That was a bell that would sit on top of your grave with a rope going in on a pole to your casket. The same effect, you could pull it, it would ring the bell and alert the caretaker who lived at the cemetery that you had been buried alive and they could theoretically come and rescue you. But one problem they had is on many nights, the wind would set these bells off, giving the caretaker quite a scare thinking everyone was buried alive.
Yeah, would there be a false alarm and they'd dig up a grave in that instance? Or maybe they'd go and say, oh, no, clearly it was the wind is blowing it.
Yes, they would double check it. And I heard from a lot of people that their churches, when they would have a funeral in the old days, would do a series of knocks. At the very beginning, when they closed the coffin, they would knock several times and listen for a response. On the way to the graveyard, they would knock several times. And then on the last, right before lowering the tomb in, they would knock again and listen just to give somebody a chance in case they were buried alive.
Talking to Chad Lewis, researcher and author. He's written a lot about the supernatural and other strange stories here in Wisconsin and around the world. He's talking now about, it's October, we're looking at burial traditions, some strange ones from eras past. And Chad, you say some customs and rituals were based on being worried about supernatural stuff, vampires, that kind of thing. What went on?
Yes, it's amazing how superstitious people were in that era. And everything from putting a iron bar on the casket of a loved one with the belief that they could not, spirits cannot pass through iron. Or you would see an iron gate around their grave, not to keep us out like most people think, but to keep the spirits in. But in rural places around the world, they would often bury their loved one with a brick in their mouth, so they could not come back as a vampire. Or if you were afraid of someone you had wronged in life coming back to haunt you, you'd bury them face down. So if they woke up and tried to dig their way out, they would actually be digging deeper into the ground. So a lot of these weird procedures that people had to do to protect themselves from the paranormal.
Were there particular times and places where these worries about some kind of weird supernatural thing happening with the recently deceased were really important to people?
It was really the height of it. It was the late 1800s, early 1900s, which also was the height of the spiritualist movement, which believed that when you die, not only does your spirit continue on, but you could contact that spirit through a seance or a medium or psychic. And it was, for high society, it was great to be invited on the weekend to a seance in town. That was the hip thing to do at the time, is to be invited, and they'd have a big seance with a traveling medium that would come in, and people would be fearful that their loved ones were unhappy with them in the afterlife.
And you mentioned earlier, Chad, that we didn't used to do things in funeral homes and whatnot. We had home funerals very often. Can you give us a sense of what these were like?
Yes, they were somber events, but also a celebration of the life. That it's so amazing, people actually collect death photos, because oftentimes when someone passed on, Uncle Lewis or what be it, that people would gather and take photos with the deceased body, especially children, and they would carry that photo around, because oftentimes, again, that might be the only photo they had of that relative. And it wasn't creepy. It wasn't seen as spooky or gruesome. It was seen as everyday part of life. And there are a lot of collectors who are picking those photos out of old flea markets and the like, who are interested in the historic relevance of them.
And that's got to be a big prize for people who are doing family genealogy, I guess. Probably once you go back to a certain era, this is the kind of picture you might be able to find of your ancestors.
Yeah, it may be the only photo you had, because, again, especially in the late 1800s, early 1900s, if you had a photo, it was very expensive. So oftentimes, the only photo some people would have is when they were deceased.
And finally, a big topic in October, and thinking about horror stories and the supernatural, the idea of grave robbing. And, Chad, you say that used to be an industry for a while. Why?
Yes, people could make a living being a grave robber. And what they would do is follow the obituary sections in newspapers. And as soon as someone was buried, they would go out that night, dig them up, and take the body. And they did it not out of some gruesome, serial killer type lurking. They did it because they were hired by the nation's medical facilities and our colleges, that these programs did not have enough cadavers for the medical students to work on. So they would, under the table, hire these grave robbers to steal bodies, bring them to the university where they could conduct their medical procedures on them. So many people earned quite a living doing this.
And that, I guess, thankfully went away as we developed this system where people could donate their remains to science, right?
Yes, and of course, once people started being buried with concrete over them to make it much more difficult than just digging a hole and retrieving the body. So we tried to prevent this on many different areas and aspects of it.
And Chad, before we let you go, what kind of stories are you looking to collect yourself? What kind of stories are you hunting for when it comes to burial customs?
I always love family traditions, that when there's a whole set of rituals you had to go through when someone died in your house. First thing was to open a window so the spirit could leave your house. You'd have to cover the mirrors so death could not come after you. You'd have to take the body feet first out so they would not look back at your house and attach their spirit there. But I'm looking for a lot of the local traditions that may have only been practiced by one congregation or one family. Those are the things that really interest me because, as I say, nothing is as weird as death.
Good place to leave it. Chad, thanks for joining us again.
Keep an eye out.
That's Chad Lewis. He's written over 20 books on folklore and the supernatural. He'll be talking more about burial traditions on Wednesday, October 17th at the Sun Prairie Public Library. That talk starts at 6:30. It's free and open to the public. The United States and Saudi Arabia have had a long-lasting diplomatic and economic partnership since the 1930s. While the two countries have had that relationship for decades, it has been complicated. And the recent disappearance of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi has raised the tension between the two countries. It's alleged that Khashoggi, a well-known critic of the Saudi Arabian government, was abducted, possibly murdered, by Saudi agents at the nation's embassy in Istanbul. The White House and Congress are seemingly at odds over how to react to that event. Saeed Khan is a senior lecturer in Near East and Asian Studies and Global Studies at Wayne State University. Saeed, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, before we dig into the deeper relationships, there's still unanswered questions about the disappearance of Jamal Khashoggi. What are you looking at in this story as all the countries involved look for details here?
Well, as things unfurl, Rob, what we do have is perhaps the most intriguing information, which is the Turkish government, because this allegedly took place at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. Has claimed that they have both audio and video evidence showing not only that Khashoggi entered the consulate and not only that he didn't leave the consulate, but that he, in fact, was tortured, murdered, and possibly even dismembered inside it. Now, how the Turks were able to get such valuable information and intelligence probably caused them to be a little bit reluctant initially to disclose that information because it suggests that they have been spying on foreign governments within sovereign soil, consulates inside their own countries. But nonetheless, that could then prove to be extremely embarrassing for not just the Saudis, but also the Trump administration, which thus far has at the very least been dawdling in its criticism and call for a thorough investigation from what otherwise is being considered one of the more important geostrategic allies of the United States in the Persian Gulf.
Let's give a listen to President Trump when he was asked what the U.S. planned to do in response. Here's what he had to say. This was yesterday, I believe, at a bill signing.
First, I want to find out what happened. And we're looking. Again, this took place in Turkey. And to the best of our knowledge, Khashoggi is not a United States citizen. Is that right? Or is that right? He's a permanent resident. Okay. We don't like it, John. We don't like it. And we don't like it even a little bit. But as to whether or not we should stop $110 billion from being spent in this country, knowing they have four or five alternatives, two very good alternatives, that would not be acceptable to me. Okay, but we're looking for the answer, and I think probably you'll have an answer sooner than people think.
So let's dig into a couple different parts of that statement. Some people have read that comment that he's not a citizen, that this was in Turkey, technically on Saudi sovereign soil, as you mentioned, in the embassy. People saw that as the president distancing himself and the American government from criticizing Saudi Arabia. What do you make of that part of the statement?
Well, the United States has never been reluctant in the past to demand investigations for what it sees as being egregious conduct by various state actors around the world, even if it does not concern an American citizen or American resident. Here we do have, in the case of Jamal Khashoggi, a lawful permanent resident, a green card holder, if you will. And although he is not correctly, I mean, as the president says, a citizen, it still would trigger, one would think, certain kinds of demands to be placed. But I think the perhaps the more important element in that is the president invoking the economics of this, which in many ways really does then define the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia for the better part of eight decades now. The fact that it's not just about oil, but it's about defense contracts, here talking about $110 billion, is a moment of almost refreshing candor that an American administration is being forthright with what exactly is the relationship between the kingdom and Washington. At the same time, it's erroneous to say that because of what the president feels is a hands-tied approach, that were the United States to exert more influence and pressure on Riyadh, that they would somehow become petulant and turn elsewhere to purchase weapons in what is, after all, a very lucrative and competitive arms market. The Saudis will not purchase arms from Russia. They will not purchase arms from China, first of all, because they haven't ever had them. Second of all, there's a lot of technical know-how, there's a lot of spare parts, and there's a lot of maintenance that goes into that, along with, actually, the training that goes into learning how to operate these munitions. That has all been, for the last eight decades, really within the exclusive province of the U.S., and perhaps maybe to a lesser degree, Great Britain. So that concern that President Trump has is really ill-conceived.
Talking to Saeed Khan from Wayne State University about the latest between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia after the disappearance of a journalist of Saudi origin, a Washington Post columnist at the Saudi embassy in Istanbul. Saeed, taking a little step back now and putting this in some wider context, this is all going on in the midst of this war, basically, in Yemen. Saudi Arabia and its allies in the region involved in this, with U.S. blessing, going back to the Obama administration, using U.S.-made arms. We've got some senators from both parties in the last few months saying, hey, we should reconsider selling these arms. Talk about how Yemen fits into all of this.
Well, Yemen looms very largely because, after all, Saudi Arabia has been conducting operations there now for almost 5 years, in at least a stated effort to repel Iran's influence there. And yes, Iran certainly is supporting the Houthi rebels in Yemen. But the fact that Iran then becomes the boogeyman and is seen as the specter of real fear and real existential threat seems to then be driving a lot of the ambivalence and perhaps even the confusion as to what to do. And this is permeating even into the United States Senate. Reflexively, it would seem as though many senators, many congresspeople would demand that there be at least a suspension, if not a further level of punitive action against Saudi Arabia, especially even when it comes to the arms sales. But at the same time, particularly Republican members of the Senate have doubled down on this idea that Iran is, in fact, the existential threat. And as a result of it, it seems as though they're willing to give the Saudis a little bit more leeway than to come down as roughly as they otherwise would.
And this all goes to one figure in the Saudi government. He's gotten a lot of attention, Mohammed bin Salman, crown prince, heir apparent. A lot of people in the West looking at him as maybe this liberalizing force, pointing to allowing women to drive, among other things. But a lot of concerns about crackdowns on his rivals, both within his family and across Saudi Arabia. Can you talk about this key figure?
Well, Mohammed bin Salman, I think, sees himself in some ways as the Great Gatsby, in other ways as Michael Corleone. I'm not sure what other movies we can really invoke in this case. Maybe Commodus from The Gladiator. But he is a 32, 33-year-old, very charming, very charismatic, very multidimensionally thinking individual. He is, in fact, a crown prince. His father, King Salman, although the titular head of Saudi Arabia, suffers from dementia, is quite old and infirm. So essentially, Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS as he's known, has been running the show in a variety of sectors. Minister of Defense, head of the Commerce and Investment Department, head of the Shura Council or the Justice Department. So essentially, the buck stops with him on all counts. He is rather impetuous. He certainly wants to move Saudi Arabia forward with his vision 2030 of modernization, of diversification of the economy beyond just oil, a certain level of liberalization. At the same time, he is an enigma and he's a paradox because on the one hand, he has given women the right to drive, which has certainly mollified the West. But at the same time, he has also jailed many women reformers and advocates and activists within the country. So he is certainly giving with one hand and what it seems taking a lot more from the other. At the same time, he has made a charm offensive in many Western capitals like Washington, but also Ottawa, London, and Paris. And as a result of it, it seems as though he has charmed Western leaders into thinking that he is the future of a new Saudi Arabia. That is something that is rather dangerous because he has taken that then as a mandate and as a license to conduct some rather egregious campaigns, not only within Saudi Arabia, but as you mentioned before, the very large humanitarian crisis that he pretty much single-handedly has caused in Yemen.
We're talking to Saeed Khan right now, senior lecturer in Near East and Asian Studies and Global Studies at Wayne State University. He's with us to talk about the diplomatic relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia and what might happen between the two countries following the disappearance and likely death of an outspoken critic of Saudi Arabia. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you following the story of the missing journalist? Are you following the story of what's going on in Yemen? What do you think the United States should do when it comes to its relationship with Saudi Arabia? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. So we continue our conversation about diplomatic relations between the United States and Saudi Arabia with Saeed Khan. He's a senior lecturer in Near East and Asian Studies and Global Studies at Wayne State University. You can join us with your thoughts and your questions at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for Saeed about the past, present, maybe future of the U.S. and Saudi Arabia? And what do you want to see from Congress, from the president, when it comes to issues like arms sales from the United States to Saudi Arabia, what's going on in Yemen, and this case of the missing journalist Jamal Khashoggi? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll go to our callers now. John is with us in Madison. John, hi.
Hi, guys. My question is kind of a fact check of President Trump and what he's been claiming. He's been claiming there's a $100 billion arms deal in the pipeline and we shouldn't do anything to mess up that arms deal. And I've heard in reports that there actually is no signed deal, that there's just like a basically a letter of intent, or there's an intent to create an arms deal. So he's factually wrong about that. And then also he keeps saying that if we mess up this arms deal, it will end up in the hands of our competitors. But my understanding is that Saudi Arabia is basically locked into U.S. Services and weapons, and there really is no competitor standing in line waiting for the deal to fall through. I just wanted to fact-check Donald Trump's claims and see what your host or your guest says about that.
Thanks for the call. Saeed, you had mentioned earlier that because Saudi Arabia has bought a lot of American products in the past, they're some ways committed to maintenance, ammunition, things like that from us for the future. But talk about that. Yeah, I've seen challenges to that idea of a billion dollar arms deal.
Right, and thank you for the question, John. The $110 billion deal would be part of a package over several years. Second of all, it's important to also remember that the United States, since the signing of the so-called Iran nuclear deal back in 2015, has increased the sale of arms to not just Saudi Arabia, but also its neighbor, United Arab Emirates, in the tune of somewhere around $12 billion per year each. So what we're talking about is a complete package over a decade of weapons. It's not just weapons. Of course, it would also be spare parts. It would be the technical training and the human capital that would go on in there. So in that sense, it is true. But John is right when it comes to whether or not there's a formal contract for these things. And part of that, I think, also has to be then taken with how close the relationship is between the United States and Saudi Arabia. When the president had gone to Saudi Arabia, which, interestingly enough, was the very first foreign country to which he went as a sitting president, he then made several deals with the king. And because the relationship between the Al Saud family and Washington has been so tight for the last eight decades, the idea then of needing a very formal written agreement is actually quite superfluous. The Saudis have certainly honored the commitments to which they have pledged in the past.
Thanks for that call, John. It's nothing new, Saeed, for U.S. presidents, administrations to have friendly relationships with Saudi Arabia. That goes back a long way. Do you see anything new and or different in the Trump administration?
Well, as you pointed out, Rob, I mean, this relationship starts off with then President Franklin Roosevelt on his way back from Yalta, meeting personally with the founding monarch of Saudi Arabia, Abdulaziz Al Saud, on a U.S. naval vessel in the middle of the Suez Canal in order to confirm American involvement, or I should say American corporate involvement, in Saudi Arabia's petroleum industry. Coming into the Nixon administration in the 1970s, President Nixon declared that Saudi Arabia, along with Iran under the last Shah of Iran, was one of America's twin pillars of U.S. policy in the region, and authorized Saudi Arabia to be eligible to purchase any conventional weapons in the American arsenal. During the 1973 Arab oil embargo, despite a formal declaration that the United States would be boycotted by the Saudis nonetheless continued to supply the U.S. military with oil for the Vietnam conflict. And then, of course, more recently, one could certainly infer, and certainly suspicion has been made about Saudi regime's complicity in 9/11. So despite all of those overtures, it shows that the relationship has been rather implacable. Now, regarding how the current administration is seeing it, perhaps the major difference that we find is, unlike any previous president, this president has actual financial ties to the Saudis that predate his election and seem to still be persisting there. So the personal benefit to the president is something that is unique and is unprecedented, so to speak.
Saeed, in our last minute or so, what are you watching for next, either from the Saudis or from the U.S. Congress?
I think what we're going to find from the Saudis is some effort to at least placate Washington, and it seems as though the bar is pretty low when it comes to the White House as to what that really means, some kind of an investigation, and here we're finding people who are under investigation investigating themselves, and that may not really lead to anything conclusive. At the same time, it'll be interesting to see if Congress will depart from the White House line and try to push for at least some kinds of sanctions or suspension in those arms deals that have been pledged.
We'll leave it there for now. Saeed, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me again.
Saeed Khan is a senior lecturer in Near East and Asian Studies and Global Studies at Wayne State University. With us today to talk about the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia and how it might change in light of the disappearance and likely killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Democrats don't just want to keep the Affordable Care Act. Some are moving to the left. Many in the party are supporting Medicare for all. In our final feature on how health care is playing out in this year's campaigns, Shemaine Mills has this report.
The current Medicare program is so popular, attempts to change it have been described as the third rail of politics. In other words, it's so charged, it's politically untouchable. Likewise, expanding to Medicare for all was once thought to be a lethal election year issue. Not so much anymore.
That is why we have got to join every other industrialized nation by passing a Medicare for all single-payer program.
during Bernie Sanders' presidential run 2 years ago, he told massive crowds like this one in Madison that health care is a right of all people. To be sure, it's a polarizing issue. Medicare for All still sparks cries of socialized medicine among Republicans. The very same night she won the Wisconsin GOP primary, U.S. Senate candidate Leah Vukmir wasted no time criticizing incumbent Tammy Baldwin on her support for Medicare for All.
She campaigns for single-payer, government-run health care. She's not afraid to stand with the avowed socialist Bernie Sanders.
But there are signs the public may be warming to the idea. The most recent Marquette poll found a majority of Wisconsin residents in favor of Medicare for All. Likewise, a national poll by the Kaiser Family Foundation showed a majority of Americans support a government-run, single-payer health care system. That support increases when talking about Medicare as a public option. Tammy Baldwin supports both.
These are all ideas worthy of debate right now, because while we narrowly defeated the effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act, our work is not done and we have got to address costs.
Baldwin says Medicare for All would reduce administrative costs and simplify a complicated system families find frustrating, like 55-year-old Bob Morrison from West Bend.
It gets hard sometimes to figure it all out, so sometimes you wish it would just be, hey, we can just go to the doctor and get taken care of.
Morrison says his wife had thyroid cancer along with hip and knee replacements. They resulted in surprise bills their insurer sometimes resisted paying. The self-described independent, who voted for Presidents Obama and Trump, sees flaws in the current health care system, but isn't necessarily ready for a big change.
You know, and I'm not so far against the, quote, single-payer system. I mean, we pay taxes for Social Security and everything out. If we pay taxes for that, the only problem I have is putting the government in charge of all that money. That's scary.
Polls show support for single payer drops off when people are asked about the potential cost. Then there's the logistics, transforming an entire system that relies heavily on private insurance now. It may be a heavy lift politically, but some like Lisa Marie Ludwig, a social worker from northern Wisconsin, hold out hope.
The only solution is to have a sort of baseline coverage that everyone is eligible for in the country. I know that politically we have a long way to go for that.
History suggests the odds could be long. There have been efforts to create a nationalized health care system dating back to 1945. If there's a difference now when it comes to Medicare for All, it's that more Democrats are willing to talk about it. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can hear WPR's full three-part series on healthcare in the 2018 campaign at WPR.org. And some more campaign information, a debate tonight between Wisconsin Attorney General candidates Brad Schimmel and Josh Call. You can hear that tonight at 7:30 here on Wisconsin Public Radio, moderated by Wisconsin Public Television's Frederica Freiberg and WPR's Sean Johnson. And tomorrow, a Senate candidate debate. Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin and Republican challenger Leah Vukmir again join WPR for live coverage at 7 tomorrow. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, a historian tells the history of two ideas, America First and the American Dream, and how they've come into conflict throughout U.S. history. And a Wisconsin author shares a new book aimed at sparking creativity for young girls. That and look at some of the top news stories of the day coming up Monday here on Central Time.